So we're going to try something a bit different, Adam. I want to talk to you about one of our sponsors. You know that I used to have like a digital marketing agency, and so I know a fair bit about this space. The sponsor that we've got here, they're called Bench Media. They've basically developed an approach to this, which I think is pretty innovative. And instead of going to one particular agency, buying from a particular agency and engaging with them, it's essentially they've got a platform, and you go onto that platform and they've got a whole ton of data and media partners there. Like they've got 100 data and media partners, and you know, you put your various needs on there, whether it's digital or it's out of home, which is billboards or whatever it might be, and effectively they match you. That feels to me, have you heard of anything else that's like that before?
I haven't. I know when we buy our media, we have a digital agency, we do a bit in-house, and we use, there's another agency for out of home, there's another agency for radio, there's another agency for TV, we have our own agency. It's really confusing, and it's really hard to, I think the one really good thing that, one of the many good things that Bench Media do is they do some really good attribution. So one of the big things about brand marketing is 50%, as classically say, 50% works, but you don't know which 50%. And what these guys do is some media mix modeling and path to acquisition, some really smart things that help. You don't have to be super sophisticated billion-dollar marketing budgets to be able to use the tools they built. So they really take what usually start at the enterprise level and bring it to small businesses and medium businesses.
Yeah, I think, to me, that's like, this is a really interesting sponsor for us to have, to be honest. Like, I think this is quite novel and innovative. I will say what they said to me in pitching was, like, you need, if you spend $1 million a year, like, this solution can work. And I thought, you know, that's like something worth taking a look at and pretty interesting. And they said to me they're customers include Nestle, Samsonite, Epson. So like there's some serious companies that are using them. So I reckon actually it's pretty interesting and like worth a look.
I think Cricket Australia as well. I think there's some really big customers and I'm super happy to work with agency and a platform that is really taking to the next level. So if you want to speak to Bench Media, you can give them a call on 1-300-049-498 or you can go to benchmedia.com and see what they can do to take your media marketing mix to the next level.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to The Contrarians with Adam and Adir, the only pod that takes you behind the scenes and gives you the inside word on the world of tech and growth from the insiders. I'm Adam Schwab, co-founder of Luxury Escapes, journalist and angel investor, and I'm joined by my great mate, Adir Schiffman, executive chairman of Catapult Sports and serial investor. And in this week's show, we discuss the rise and rise of Katy Perry, the collapse of the healthy mummy, and the retirement of Rupert Murdoch. So, Adir, welcome back to episode 6 of The Contrarians. Always good to be here.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
I've just got off a New Zealand flight. I must say, have you flown in New Zealand before?
I used to fly it extensively.
You don't anymore?
No, I used to do lots of work for them, and I used to fly them extensively. And the prerequisite for my deal with them, my contract, was that they had to include a business class return flight. I was actually in my late 20s or early 30s. And so, yeah, that was like this amazing perk. I could not afford to fly business class. And so I used to love that airline, and the people that worked for it were just lovely people.
So this is in your Global Reviews days.
Exactly.
I don't fly New Zealand a lot, but I always came back from skiing for a week, and they are just an incredible airline. The service is unbelievable. The people are so nice. They don't have business class. They've got this really interesting where you can sort of book out the middle seat. So it's as good as, in many ways, not as good as business class. Mm-hmm. The food's pretty good. It runs on time. It's just everything you sort of want from an airline, they have. It's such a great experience.
I did once fly them to LA, and their business class was very strange. The seats all faced inwards so that you're basically facing everybody else while sitting in business class, as opposed to facing out the window and having privacy. And I thought it's kind of a good parable for New Zealand, right?
Like they're also friendly.
Yeah, very friendly. And I think they're much more about, we'll create a nice community experience when you travel in business class. Don't just look out the window and disconnect yourself from other human beings. That's a strange setup.
But anyway, so the New Zealand experience was great. And so I get off and I'm waiting for bags. And it's a bit of a debacle because my in-laws arrived from London at the same time. And my wife had gone, I pick up my bags and I walk out of customs and I realize, God, I've left a bag in
next to the conveyor belt, what an idiot. So I run back, and of course, I try to go into customs, and like this alarm goes off. I thought they're going to put me in like Manus Island or something. So like this, and they go, get out, as if I'm going to like, who knows what they thought I was going to do, like just run, dude. And I said, how do I get my bag? I said, the bag was like 20 meters away. It wouldn't have been hard for someone to get it. But I said, you got to speak to Border Force. So I go to Border Force, nice enough. And they said, no, we can't help you. You got to go next door to Swissport. Go next door to Swissport. This is whose sort of app everybody's outsourced the baggage stuff to.
Yep.
And there's one guy in Swissport, he's knocking the door, lets me in. And I said, I've left my bag inside. He goes, and he gets on the radio, Alpha Charlie, Foxtrot, all this stuff. And he's getting in. He goes, come back in half an hour. And he goes, they're not clearing it. So, you know, this guy has sort of gone, taken over himself. He's left his post. He's sort of charged through. 5 minutes later, come back with my bag. Like, what a guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
He could have said, tough luck, send us a letter. He's left his post. He's gone 500 meters to get the bag. He's trawled through Border Force. He doesn't know me. He doesn't know. And surely there are some pretty good people still out there.
Was it in Auckland?
No, this was in Melbourne.
Oh, really? Okay. I mean, but the guy that was helping you was a Kiwi?
No, he's a two different stories. New Zealand's finished.
The whole thread
this
of
is an Australian guy. sort of Australian guy working at Swissport in Melbourne who did such an incredible. I'm sure the New Zealand Border Force would have been far more friendly. This is the Australian Border Force.
My experience with customs in Australia, and this was my experience in New Zealand as well, is unbelievably positive relative to almost every other place in the world, and certainly compared to the US. Like, just the general kindness and nice disposition of Australian airport workers, especially customs and border force, it's much, much better than what you get overseas. Like, you get the odd one that's maybe not, but yeah, generally the experience is really positive. I completely agree. I was once going through immigration to get into New Zealand via Auckland, and I just got randomly stopped. This is probably 20 years ago, and I just got randomly stopped. And they start, you know, looking through my bags, which is fine, but they spend a long time rifling through my bags, through everything. I don't know what they're looking for, bombs or something. And at one point, you know, my disposition was slightly different in my 20s, and I turned to the person and I said, let me tell you something. I was born in Israel. If someone is trying to bomb you, it's me that they're actually trying to bomb. He was bemused.
So usually I think customs are very good. I think just obviously when something goes wrong, obviously this was my fault, when something goes wrong, they're not quite so good. But in almost every other instance I've had it, they've all been good. But let's move on to our first story, which is about Katy Perry, who has become one of the richest self-made women in America after selling her music rights to a private equity firm for $225 million US. That means her net worth, according to Forbes, is US $340 million. Following the sale, Perry now joins the ranks of other super-rich female musicians, including Madonna, Beyoncé, Celine Dion, Dolly Parton, and Barbara Streisand. The richest female musicians are Taylor Swift, who is worth $740 million US. And the number one, do you know who the number one is, Adir? Can you take a guess?
That's a good question. Beyoncé?
No, but sort of. So number one is Rihanna, who is $1.4 billion. And she's actually, have you heard of, she's got a beauty brand called Fenty Beauty in partnership with LVMH.
I did know about that.
She's worth $1.4 billion. The richest musician is actually hip-hop mogul and Beyonce's husband. So you're kind of half right, Jay-Z, who's worth $2.5 billion. So I didn't actually realize these musicians were worth so much, but I think you've looked at this a bit, Adir. Tell me about the concept of musicians selling their back catalogues, and how has this become such a lucrative pastime?
Well, I would say they're generally not, when you say you didn't realize musicians are this rich, it's like looking at some NBA basketball players and saying, I never realized that people that play basketball are this rich. Like, they're mostly not. They mostly just shoot hoops on the weekend. So I think, you know, this is like my experience with entertainment and pro sports and all of these types of things is it's so the success, the part of the pyramid that represents extreme success, it is so thin and so small. Like, of all of the things you could do if you wanted to become successful, this is not the thing to kind of play the odds at. But, you know, obviously there are some that are very successful. I think the idea of selling back catalogues is just it is a good illustration of how the world over time is just becoming increasingly sophisticated with regards to financial instruments. If you think about the world 400 years ago, the very concept of annuities was not going to be a well understood concept. The way they were, how they were funding wars, like it was very, very primitive by our standards. And finance has just become so sophisticated. And what has happened is that private equiteers that are investing large amounts of other people's money have worked out the amount of money that you get from royalties is relatively predictable over a period of time, especially from a back catalogue. And so what you can do is buy it and effectively get a rate of return on it that makes it akin to an infrastructure asset or anything else. And you can go and make some money out of that. And, ideally they're going to flip it on at some point and it will appreciate. But, this is all a hallmark of the sophistication that exists in financial instruments and the huge amount of money that's sloshing around trying to find a manager to generate a return. So it's kind of cool from a business point of view and a bit sad from a romantic point of view, I think.
Question for you here. So you've got Katy Perry who's got this back catalogue, and Katy's presumably earning royalties every year directly. She sells, so let's say Katy Perry's making $10 million a year. I'm just making a number up from royalties. She sells the asset to a company called Litmus Music, which is the buyer in this case, for $225.
It's backed by like KKR or something. Like it's PA.
I think it's backed by Carlyle. I think Carlyle backed. So she sells the rights, but how is it more efficient economically for Katy Perry to not continue to own those rights? Ultimately, the private equity guys are trying to make a return. They've got a management fee. How is it economically efficient for somebody to sell to a third party that charges a fee? Just if I'm talking back to first principles, Isn't it more economic efficient for Katy Perry to continue to own those rights and earn a royalty? Because she's now got to invest the $225 million somewhere else and get a return and pay a fee to somebody.
Well, I think it's great because it's very smart by Katy Perry. Like, firstly, she does get all of that money up front. So even putting the economics aside, she's massively de-risked herself. I mean, she gets to have this pot of money and not worry about what royalties look like in future. Like, she could get cancelled in 5 years. I don't think she will, but like, the world is an unpredictable place. And so she's got this pile of money. But more significantly, like, the UK probably has different tax rates to Australia, but I'll use Australian tax rates for this example. You would know this. Like, we all think about these things. Your notional $10 million of royalties that she gets, that's income. So $5 million of that is going straight to the ATO if that was Australia. And that sucks. Basically, that's a lot of money. And her $225 million is a capital gain. That's an asset. Presumably, the cost of the asset is close to zero. So that it's all gain, let's imagine. And so she's going to pay 25% tax on that $225 million. And so the delta of that is more than $50 million. She's pocketed over the presumable life of that asset more than $50 million of extra money because she's not paying tax on it. She's got the benefit of the time cost of money. She's getting all of that money now. And, presumably the buyer is hoping that the royalties significantly outstrip the amount that they've paid, even including the time cost of money. I reckon they'll flip it, right? It sounds to me like this is a business that's buying a whole ton of assets off various artists to put together some kind of scale, and then they'll flip it to someone else who is going to continue doing it or whatever it is. But I think, as a tax play, this is a very efficient tax play.
Yeah, that's a great point. I didn't think about the tax arbitrage, which is completely correct. And people are critical of capital being taxed at different income, and that's a pretty good example of it. I've got some sympathy for capital obviously being taxed at a lower rate. There's a reason for it, But yeah, this is a great example, and you're right. And Katy Perry certainly isn't the first and won't be the last person to monetize.
I think we'll see more of these types of deals. Like, I think the idea of financiers pushing the envelope further and further to try and create assets that they can buy and sell, like, this is a phenomenon that is only going to become more prevalent over time. I mean, the world is so much richer than it was a few hundred years ago. There is so much more money.
Thanks, Adir. And let's hear from one of our great sponsors.
Adam, I assume you've claimed the R&D tax incentive at some point.
Oh, it's the best thing I do all year.
That's very positive. Well, I also think it's fantastic. I mean, it pays back up to 43.5% of genuine R&D, and you can get a cash payment as well as a tax incentive. But the problem that I found is the process potentially can be a nightmare to manage.
Not only that, if you do it wrong, you actually get a really big fine from the tax office. So it's something that you want to be really careful with.
Agree. I mean, compliance is challenging. But the good news is our friends at Rimon Advisory specialize in managing the entire process and can also help claim everything that you're entitled to. They've been doing it for 12 years. I can say that I honestly actually use them for my startups, and their co-MD, Lior Steen, is really responsive in my experience. So you should go to their website, Rimon, that's rimon.com.au, where you can learn more, use their free calculators, and drop them a line. Now it's back to the contrarians.
And now for our second story, and this is one idea you've been following closely and have written about in your fantastic financial review column, and that is the rise and fall of a business called The Healthy Mummy that was founded by Welsh entrepreneur Rhianne Allen. Allen conceived the idea of The Healthy Mummy in 2010 while pregnant with her first son. Then in her early 30s, she quit her executive role at Australian Consolidated Press and sold the family home to fund The Healthy Mummy. Last year, Allen sold the business to listed food company Halo Foods for what was purported to be $17 million. At the time, The Healthy Mummy was believed to be earning over $20 million a year, with almost half that revenue coming from subscriptions. Fast forward 18 months, and The Healthy Mummy has been sold for only $600,000. And just a few weeks ago, Halo was placed in voluntary administration. I should note here, dear, I'm slightly conflicted knowing the former CEO of Halo as a friend. And you've been over this story a lot. So why don't you, can I love to get your take on what happened?
I mean, I think this is a debacle. I don't think it's a malicious debacle. I just think it's a debacle. The Healthy Mummy is a business that when it was acquired effectively had two halves. One half was an app that focused on nutrition and exercise and these types of things. It's a nice app. And the other half was effectively products. So I think drinks, but also some equipment, you know, and the brand quite well known amongst its customer base. The weird thing about this business is it's the only business involved in e-commerce and the digital world I have ever come across that did not grow its revenue during COVID. That was one of the most bizarre things. And I think I originally wrote about this in 2022. It wasn't long. I mean, this whole buying for 20 mil and selling for $600,000 happened within a year and a half. So like that's a pretty rapid value destruction experience. But I never understood how it didn't grow during COVID, and I still don't understand. I never understood how they got to the price that they paid. So little was disclosed at the time of the acquisition. And, you know, I try to be a bit gentle when I write these columns in the Financial Review because, like, business is hard and we all make mistakes. Like, I've made tons of mistakes, and some mistakes I've made in the context of a public company setting. You do your best. But, and so, you know, I know what it's unpleasant, right? And so, And so I try to be a bit gentle because everyone's mostly just doing their best. But I really never understood this. And I thought and wrote that the price that they paid might end up becoming a problem. And it became a huge problem. But it did not become a problem in the way that I predicted, to be honest. It became a problem because this Halo business, I mean, it was the inverse. Halo and the Healthy Mummy were inverse businesses. The Healthy Mummy could not grow its top line even during COVID, but somehow massively grew its profitability during COVID in ways that I never understood. Probably the CAC went down, but it really grew. I think it grew its profitability as a percentage, something insane like 20,000% or something like that. And Halo was the exact opposite. It got this top line growth and could never turn it into actually making any money. And so I understood like the rationale for it. It was just very confused. And Halo had some other debt, and what they did is they did what we all think about in the public company world, which is if you're going to do a transaction, work out how much money you need and work out if there's any more capital it would be useful to have. And so they did that, and that makes sense. But this is what they did that I would not be doing. They decided to retire some debt and make this acquisition by taking more debt. And they effectively funded the acquisition almost entirely, if you move the pieces around, almost all of it was with new debt they took from a company. I think the lender was called Arrowpoint or something along those lines. And the problem with taking this debt is that it came with some covenants, which means effectively promises that a borrower makes to a lender. And one of those covenants was about being able to, you know, pay the interest and interest cover. But another one was that they would never drop below $2 million of cash in the bank. And ultimately, you know, that is a dangerous game to play. That's my view on acquisitions with debt. I don't know if you have similar views or, you know, if you feel like they were just unlucky here.
There's a bit of a backstory to this, and I think your comments are really interesting. I think you really got to look at this transaction with reference to the transaction that happened a couple of years or maybe 18 months before it. So what happened? So Halo was a company that was previously called Ketone, and Ketone was a business that was funded. I think there was a Russian guy who essentially funded the business. I'm not sure the guy's name, but he funded the business. I think it was about 2017. I think everybody saw the success of A2.
Because you mean it was a dairy business, essentially?
Yeah, it was a New Zealand kind of dairy business. It was a New Zealand guy who was running it. This Russian guy funded it. And a guy called Peter James came in as the chairman. And Peter James is quite a well-known technology person who's actually, do you remember that business Computer Power in the 80s and 90s? They had those ads and
of
smashing.
Course.
I'm not sure how many, I completely forgot until I did a bit of research on this guy, but he ran that business for like 16 years and would have done quite well. I think it was, I don't know what happened to it in the end, but I think it was in its day, obviously had lots of ads with the guy smashing through the wall. So clearly had some media budget back then. So this Peter James guy ran that business, and that business finished in 2000, maybe it was sold, I can't remember. And he became a professional director, essentially. He was director of IINet for a number of years. IINet was a great success story. And then he's been on a bunch of boards, probably like 10 or so technology boards. Nearmap is probably the most well-known one. So Nearmap was one of those great technology runaway stories and became a bit of a disaster, actually. Its share price dropped from $4 to $1. And then it was saved by a private equity firm, Thoma Bravo, who paid a couple of dollars a share for it. This Peter James guy chairing Nearmap, which obviously was a moderate success in the end, but was doing a lot better at one point. He also, I think, was chairing a business called, or on the board of a business called Drone Shield, which is a drone business, I think also funded by the same Russian guy who funded Ketone. And I think about 3 years ago, Ketone bought or did a sort of merger with a Melbourne-based business called OmniBlend, which was a quite a decent business. It was making, I think, $10 plus million in sales. It was profitable. And eventually Ketone didn't really have a business. It was a lot of sizzle, not much steak. And OmniBlend was a genuine operating business. I think the aim was put the two together. OmniBlend provides the operational nous, and Ketone had the big name board and big name board members. Inside Ketone, there was a guy called Jordan Thompson, who was the CFO, who looks like he's sort of Peter James's acolyte in many ways. He worked for a guy called Robert Clisdell. Robert Clisdell, by all accounts, is a nice guy. He's a Green Hills banker and was pretty closely associated with Peter James. And obviously the Russian guy is the common link there. Clisdell obviously worked with this Jordan Thompson guy. So the CFO and Clisdell and James were obviously very close. And then later on, Peter James installed a lady called Susan Close, who was also director at Nearmap. So there's sort of three associates of Peter James on this board, because it's Ketone, which became Halo board. And there was a couple of OmniBlend guys on there. So essentially what I understand happened is the Ketone guys controlled the board. The
Healthy Mummy acquisition
was made by Jordan Thompson and Peter James.
Thoma Bravo, who paid a couple of million dollars for it,
who overrode objection. There was directors who objected to the acquisition. So I think what happened was Jordan Thompson, who was the CFO, went out and found this business, this Healthy Mummy business, massively overpaid for it. As I said, used debt, God knows why, used debt to fund the transaction. Paid $17 million for a business that was sold for $600,000 18 months later. This is, I don't want to use the word criminal, but it's almost certainly appears negligent by Thompson and Peter James to effectively destroy what was a reasonably strong business.
I mean, I don't think it's not criminal conduct. I mean, so I tell you why I'm.
I don't think it's criminal, but it's certainly negligent.
Like, you've got a lot of insight into what happened here. For me, when I write my pieces, what I do is just use publicly available information and write them from that. And the reason is, we know we're very connected in the business world, obviously, and we know what's going on, and we speak to people confidentially, and I never want people to feel like their conversations with me are going to form the basis for any of the article. But so this is all, you know, news to me, and I actually didn't know any of this. I tell you why I'm more sympathetic to this maybe than you are. Acquisitions mostly fail. There's lots of data on that. It's irrefutable. Acquisitions are mostly value destructive. They don't usually destroy value at this rate of destruction, but the direction of this, I don't think, is in any way surprising in the grand scheme of where acquisitions usually end up. And Catapult Roll, we've made a number of acquisitions. I think they've generally gone pretty well, like they've been value accretive, but no acquisition, you know, survives first contact with the acquiring company. It's maybe how I'd modify that. And so they are difficult. This one, I personally think, if they would have bought this, rolled it in, done it through issuing shares to shareholders and burnt through that cash, you'd have some disgruntled shareholders, but that's pretty normal with lots of smaller companies making acquisitions, and they would have survived it. They certainly wouldn't be in voluntary administration and receivership, which is when the lender appoints somebody to take control of the assets and protect the lender effectively. So I think fundamentally that, like, overpaying is not what killed them, and all of that backstory, like, you know, it doesn't sound good. It's not what killed them. What killed them is they borrowed $13 million and then the business tanked and their core business was never going to ride to the rescue. And the lender actually seems like they got how imperiled their position was, because not only did they waive the covenants once, they actually allowed Halo not to repay some of the principal, which is never a good sign. When your lender's saying, we see that you are so imperiled that even asking for a piece of our money back might push you over the edge, like, that is not a good sign. And ultimately, their cash balance dropped below $2 million and they ended up in voluntary administration and receivership. I think that there will be enough money to pay the lender, is my gut feel on this. I think the lender will get back their money. There are some assets there. The Healthy Mummy, I mean, you know where that, you know who bought that? We'll see if you read my article.
Mosh bought it, didn't they? Yeah. Yeah, of course I read your article. Mosh is the hair replacement. Isn't it the sort of hair business?
They're like a eucalyptus competitor. I know the guys there. I know David Narunsky is one of the guys. They're smart. You know, they're well-funded. They do a good job. They're the smaller player relative to eucalyptus, which is Tim Doyle. I know Tim Doyle very well. He's a superstar. It's not just hair replacement, right? The thing that's driving these businesses now predominantly is the weight loss injectables, like Ozempic and
Ozempic.
Yeah, Ozempic and the analogs. So that's really what's driving these businesses predominantly at the moment. What's interesting about it is that this industry is starting to have quite a heavy focus on interesting, albeit smaller, acquisitions. What they're doing is they're buying up brands that have a following but have struggled. And so it's kind of like what the Kogan guys do with, you know, they did it with a few, but Dick Smith was the original one I think they did it with, and they've done it with a few subsequently. And so Mosh has bought this brand, the Healthy Mummy. Tim Eucalyptus bought Jenny Craig. So that's where that brand went to. And so I think it's going to be Instant Scripts, which was Usher Freilich. I don't know if you know him. He's actually a fantastic guy. He just sold that to Wesfarmers.
Good business, though. Great business.
Yeah, just sold to Wesfarmers. So this is a business that has a lot of there's a lot of M&A activity that is floating around this industry at the moment, and I think it's going to be a very interesting industry to watch.
Let's go back to the original the Halo thing. There's one thing to actually point out with Halo. We talk about corporate governance. So Peter James and Jordan Thompson, his protege, CFO, and there's a couple other directors, they all issued themselves. So this is while the business was effectively going under, slowly going under. Issued themselves ZPO, so zero-priced options, which they then exercised into shares pretty much straight away. And I'm not sure if they actually sold them or not. But that was, so you've got a business that was effectively really struggling. The directors issuing themselves and a CFO shares. The CFO was paid $1.8 million in 2022. The CFO, this is a business that lost, I think, $30 million that year. You've got the CFO being paid ridiculous amounts of money by his chairman. I actually don't know how Peter James can remain on the boards he's on, given what's happened at this business.
Your number one objective in life is to just get chairs to resign from boards. I've got to make sure I've got to stay on your good side.
I think you're the only good chair of any ASX company. There were some good chairmen. Pat O'Sullivan, who's a former chairman of mine, who chairs car sales, is an incredible chairman.
Andrew McAvoy, who's actually my current chair at Lux and chairs Camplify, is a ripper. I also really like Hamish McLennan, who chairs REA and ARN Media.
There were some very, very good chairmen out there. I don't think this guy is one of them. Chairman's, in a way, the most important person at a business, because they obviously hire and fire the CEO. We'll talk about Richard Goiter, as always, later in the show. But they have a very important role. And clearly here you've got a chairman dealing himself zero-priced options, dealing his colleagues who are on the board zero-priced options. They're cashing them in for shares. They're making an acquisition for using debt. I know it's a small business, so which is sort of off-Broadway a bit. It's only what was, I think it was capped at $60 million at its peak. So it's an off-Broadway business. But this is, in my view, outrageous that somebody can oversee this and remain on boards like Macquarie Telecom, which is, I think, a $3 billion business, on drone. He's on the board of a number of big businesses while this has happened.
If you want to get yourself worked up, you should go and look at it was either their half-yearly report or their full-year report. It must have been their half-yearly. I can't remember. That came out just before all of this happened. And you should go read the statements made by directors about whether the business is a going concern and whether they'll be able to pay their debts and confidence. That will get you worked up. Because, I mean, I was – the happiest thing is not ever having to put out those kinds of reports when you're under that type of pressure. It must be absolutely terrible. And you've got these auditors crawling all over you because – they're stressed about it. The one good bit about this story, semi-good bit, is the founder, who I don't know, Rhiann Allen, she quit her job and sold her house to pump the money to start the Healthy Mummy. And then her husband came and worked for the business as well. Like, that is as all in as you can be. And when I calculated how much she took off the table, I reckon it might have been approaching $10 million before tax, 5 to 10 mil. She sold a few shares. Her problem is she was still holding 21 million shares when the thing went into voluntary administration as the largest shareholder. But I thought that one of the saddest things about this story is that she was so proud of the fact in an article in the Fin Review that I read that she had not taken debt when she was running her company. And then she's ended up having her shares effectively suspended and potentially worthless as a consequence of, you know, a very reckless, I would say, debt-funded acquisition of her own business. So it just goes to show the importance. So this was my takeaway of all of the article, which is founders are usually exceptionally focused on building a great business, and that is often 100% of their focus. But ultimately, founders, they need to get paid. I was having this discussion with someone recently. There's not many founders I know that start businesses because they're trying to get rich. I mean, that is a pretty dumb reason to become a founder. It's low probability. But ultimately, they do need to get paid if their business is successful. And founders consistently underestimate how important, well, not even important, how central timing and structure of an exit is to whether they get rich or not. And I would say it is arguably more important than whether or not they've built a great business. There are many great businesses that went up and then came down before anybody got to take money off the table, and many very mediocre businesses that got huge exits for their founders because of timing and structure of those exits.
We actually talked about this a few weeks ago, and this is an interesting one. I think in your article you talked about this. So when it was sold, Healthy Mummy, I think, predicted a 50% increase in sales, or they forecast a 50% increase in sales. And as it turned out, revenue fell 35%. So that's a very big delta. So I don't like, so one of either the business was completely mismanaged after it was sold, which is possible, or what often happens is owners dress up a business for sale. They make the business look as good as they can. They push it as far as they can. I don't think the Halo guys were that unsophisticated. This is a former banker. Peter James is a very well-credentialed director, and Thompson is a former Greenhills banker. These are two, you'd think, relatively sophisticated people. That the acquisition turned out that badly, to me, implies that there was problems with the business before it was sold. And the smart move would have been taking a lower amount all cash. Probably, maybe they wouldn't do it. I don't know. I don't think anybody thought it would blow up the whole thing. But there's real questions to be asked on what was sold and was... So either one or two things happened. Either the Healthy Mummy was a much worse business than was purported to be, or the Halo guys who bought it were completely and utterly inept.
I would go for option one. I think when you say it was a much worse business, I think the profitability was unsustainable and it was just a moment in time. That would be my guess. And Halo was probably, you know, you look at their business before they acquired it, you can see why they needed to acquire something that had earnings and had some sexiness and about it. So I don't think they're inept. Honestly, I think my experience with Peter James is that he's sophisticated. So I don't think it was inept. I don't think it was malicious. I think it was a mistake. It was a big mistake, and they compounded it in the way that it was funded. Like, that's you know, a big lesson to take out of this. And you're right. Like, essentially, how you take money, how you take your payday is fundamentally important. And you look at Zoe Foster-Blake, who sold GoTo into BWX, another business in, I don't know what that's in now. It was in voluntary administration. I think it might be in liquidation, just a thing. I don't know what it's in. But she still owed some amount of tens of millions of dollars. It could be 80.
Half.
It's hard to
she's
know.
Owed half.
Yeah.
I think she's owed half the price. I think she got 50 and was owed 50.
In fairness, the amount that she got was more than twice the value of the business. Like, she got a great price for it.
That's a fantastic deal.
Yeah, but, and she got huge amounts of cash. And, you know, Hamish Blake, like, whatever he's earned being, and as a funny guy and successful, whatever he's earned, she would have outstripped his earnings by a significant margin. She's very sophisticated. But she also ended up in the same situation where she now has to figure out how she's going to get the rest of her money.
Well, she can potentially buy the business back.
I've heard that for months that was going to happen. For 2 months, people have said to me that she's going to end up reacquiring GoTo. And as far as I know, it still hasn't happened. That asset has not found a new home.
I think there was a bunch of assets in that business, which is another disaster.
We'll take a quick break and come back with our third story on the retirement of Rupert Murdoch and the rise of Son Lachlan.
So, Adi, what do you think of financial planning?
I think it's poorly understood, and I think it's heavily underutilized.
I couldn't agree more. There are so many bankers, lawyers, doctors, really smart people who simply don't know how to manage their money. What do you think?
I agree. I'm definitely better at making money than managing money, absolutely.
That is the case with most people. And a great solution to that is Bowden Financial. Bowden works with high-income professionals and successful business owners to build a comprehensive wealth management plan. They specialise in family succession planning. Bowden Financial are great supporters of the Contrarians podcast. Bowden are supporting our podcast with a special offer for our listeners, a 2-hour free expert consultation with the Bowden team where they will assess your personal needs and see what they can do to help. Take advantage of this great offer. Call 02-4937-0270 or go to bowdenfinancial.com.au. Now, back to the pod. And our final story is the retirement of Australian media mogul Rupert Murdoch, who announced last Thursday that he was stepping down as chairman of Fox News and News Corp. From November, Rupert will become News Corp and Fox's chairman emeritus, a title given to a past chairman who remains associated with the business. Murdoch's oldest son, Lachlan, will become the sole chairman of both businesses. So, dear, what are your thoughts on the Rupert legacy, and is he really retiring, or is this some sort of faux retirement?
I mean, he's definitely not retiring. Like, I don't believe that for a sec. Like, why would he retire? I know there's all these rumors. Like, you know, Michael Wolff has just published another book on Rupert Murdoch, which this guy seems to me to be basically obsessed with Donald Trump and Rupert Murdoch. And his claim is that at 92 years old, Rupert has lost it somewhat. Now, the problem with that claim, which sounds plausible, is that Michael Wolff is, let's call him, controversial in terms of his claims in previous books. And so that could be the reason, but I doubt it. I'll tell you one very interesting part of this story. So do you know what happens after he dies, after Rupert Murdoch dies? Like, what happens to the business?
This is the succession thing.
Yeah, each of his four adult kids, except the kids from Wendy Deng, basically, they all get to appoint one person to this, I think it's a Delaware-based trust to manage it. And this is the bit that is interesting. Do you know who Lachlan Murdoch's appointee to that Delaware trust was until recently?
Gina Cass-Gottlieb, I believe.
Yeah, like, she basically, she now runs the ACCC. It's not to cast aspersions on her. I mean, I've heard only incredibly
positive. I think she's incredible. I'm a huge Gina Cass-Gottlieb.
Yeah, yeah. People love her. But isn't it, like, how tight are the circles of power, right?
Yeah.
It's pretty remarkable. So I think it's not, like, I don't think it's a retirement. It's hard to know exactly what it is. I think clearly Lachlan is Rupert's preferred successor. And by making him an incumbent, it's going to be more difficult to replace him than it would be. It's easier for him now to hang on than if he tried to be appointed after Rupert's death. But it's pretty interesting. I mean, I've never met Lachlan, but certainly I am. Is it called 1 degree of separation or 2 degrees if you know someone that knows the person?
I think it's 2 degrees.
I never get confused about these. So let's say 2 degrees. So like I've got lots of 2 degrees of separation. So the comments and conversation I've had about Lachlan with people have been universally in the direction of he's charismatic and nice to deal with and whatever else. And obviously his REA, like the realestate.com.au conviction that he had has been a $10 billion plus win or whatever it is?
Well, I think he invested, I think it's probably the greatest Australian VC investment ever. Maybe some Canberra ones were, but it was 10 million in and that was mostly Contra. So it wasn't even really 10 million. Yeah. It was like 2 million and it's now worth 13 billion. So work that out.
It's pretty good, right? So I think this is part of a bigger plan. From what I hear, Lachlan is staying in Australia as much as he is in general. Like he travels obviously a lot.
Yeah.
Obviously there is a show called Succession, but if there wasn't a show, you could just run this as a documentary for the next few years. It would be like, it would hit record viewers every single episode because I think like this, the plot has just gotten thicker with this particular move. I don't think this is the end game at all. I think it's just, you know, another move in a very complicated succession plan.
I think you're right. I think just everybody's talking about Rupert like he's almost dead instead of eulogizing him, and he's not dead clearly. But I think it's worth just going through. Obviously, we're a business show, and let's leave aside the politics because a lot of obviously the News Corp Fox politics has been polarizing. But let's push that to a side for now. And look at Rupert's business career is just remarkable. So he obviously inherited effectively two very small Adelaide newspapers, really one small Adelaide newspaper after his father, Keith Murdoch, passed away. Keith also owned a Brisbane paper that the estate sold and Rupert later bought back. He launched the Australian newspaper when he was only 32, I think 32 years old. 4 years later, he did his first pivot and he bought News of the World in the UK. And then a few years after that, he then bought the Daily Mirror in Sydney. That automatically should be wrong, but he bought a couple other Sydney papers, eventually bought the Daily Telegraph in Sydney. And then in 1986, he effectively broke the Fleet Street unions. But have you heard of the Wapping plan? So he created this whole new out in Canary Wharf, this whole new operation. Yeah, nice. He broke the union. So he was one of the first people to break the unions. Then he pivoted again and launched a satellite cable business, and then merged it with British Satellite Broadcast and create, of course, B Sky B, and that was in 1990. And then a few years before that, he went to the US, so pivoted again and bought 20th Century Fox from a guy called, do you remember a guy called Mark Rich? This is a really interesting connection, actually.
No, I don't remember. No.
So Mark Rich is, I think he died recently. He was the guy who effectively founded Glencore, that massive Swiss space commotion. Yeah, yep. So he got exiled from the US for effectively, I think it was tax evasion or tax avoidance.
Ivan Glassenberg?
Glassenberg took over after Mark.
I see.
So Mark Rich was the original sort of commodities trader. So I didn't actually realize Murdoch bought 20th Century Fox from Mark Rich. And then he launched the Fox TV stations. He bought a business called Metro Media. That was from, I think, Marvin Davis, the oil guy. In 86, he sort of cobbled together this Fox stations and launched, frankly, there was CBS, NBC, ABC. He launched the fourth station. And that was incredible. Then a few years later, he pivoted again in a way and it was the first person to really see the value in sports and paid what seemed to be incredible money and in hindsight was an absolute bargain for the NFL rights in the States and he bought the soccer and the cricket rights in the UK.
That's right. I think he pulled them off CBS for some amount of money.
That's right.
It was considered to be complete insanity. And now what's unbelievable is that the entire world of streaming and linear broadcasting understands that the number one thing you want to get people to watch you in real time is live sports.
Yeah, exactly. And then he obviously supported Lachlan when Lachlan bought REA. We talked about that 10 million to 13 billion. And then in 2005, and he got criticized for this, but in hindsight, actually was genius again. They bought MySpace. Obviously, MySpace was a disaster and that failed, but he picked social media, which obviously Facebook won, but ultimately back in 2005, barely anybody even knew what social media was. So he got that right. And then in 2019, he sold 21st Century Fox, which remember he cobbled together in sort of 20 years earlier, for $71 billion to Disney at literally the top of the market, albeit they did get Disney shares. So you'd almost think this guy's got some sort of time machine. He got almost every trend he got right. And yes, he's made mistakes along the journey, but to get so many thematics right is almost incredible. I don't think anybody in the world has got it right so many times in so many different areas to constantly be ahead of the game. It's such a great lesson.
I tell you two stories that I've heard about him or the family, but I can't. I have to keep anonymous the people that have told me these two stories.
You've got so many anonymous sources. I don't know who's anonymous sources are.
So I know lots of people and I want to maintain the relationship. So that's why I say this is anonymous. This is the first thing that somebody told me. They said, Lachlan is exceptionally charismatic. James is so efficiently ruthless in his business dealings.
Really?
And Elizabeth has a fundamental nous and understanding for what people want to watch.
Hmm. And well, Elizabeth sold that business $700 million did MasterChef back to News Corp, I think. That's it was right. The time. Or back and to so Fox,
what,
maybe.
And so what this person said is each of those kids has those characteristics because they each got a piece of Rupert, but Rupert has it all in one person. That is one of the reasons he's been so successful. So I thought that was an interesting – and this person would know. And the other thing I heard, which is just tangential, but I thought I'd tell you, is – remember there was the show, I don't remember which streaming platform it was on. I don't even remember what it was called. It was about Roger Ailes and Fox, and it was played by Russell Crowe, right?
Yeah, that was a great show.
Great show.
It was this something, wasn't it?
Look, to be honest, I don't watch much TV streaming stuff. But anyway, I watched this, and then I spoke to someone who knows the inside of all of this, and I said, was it accurate? And they said to me that these are the two things they said were not accurate. They said Lachlan Murdoch was – like they portrayed him much weaker than he actually is as an executive. Like they didn't make him look as smart as he is. And do you know what the other thing they said was misportrayed? I was shocked by this.
No,
they said Roger Ailes was hilarious in every meeting and none of his humor. Obviously, he was demonized in that show.
Yeah.
I'm not a supporter of Fox News, but like none of his humor came out in that show whatsoever. I was shocked to hear that. I'm not sure Rupert Murdoch, like when you say we'll ignore his politics, I think his religion is pretty much money. That's all he cares about. And I think his politics is just about what is going to make him money. And he's historically been the master of supporting whoever he thinks is going to win and be in power and give him power and he can exert power. So my take on it is James and Lachlan in different directions are much more politically motivated from the heart than Rupert is.
Yeah, I think that's right. I was actually going to say a similar thing. The show was The Loudest Voice, by the way.
That's right, The Loudest Voice.
I actually agree. I think Rupert was supported Gough Whitlam, I think, in 72. He supported Tony Blair in, I think it was 96, so or 97. So he absolutely has been willing to change with the breeze. And he clearly just saw, and Scott Galloway talked about, he saw this great white space back in sort of court was the early 90s, and he realised everybody who is brought – every news broadcaster in the US pretty much and the UK was an educated, left-leaning university graduate who had a certain political persuasion. They weren't talking to 48% of the population. He goes, hold on, there's a big market here in 48% of the population. And it's a great lesson for the entrepreneurs and the founders listening to this is always be contrarian. And that's the show, but you make money by swimming against the tide. You don't make money doing what everybody else is doing. You make money by doing what people aren't doing. And that's what Murdoch consistently did for 70 years. He did what people weren't doing. And I actually don't think – and I think his politics probably followed him buying Fox News. And it was almost – I think it was a bit sort of tail wagging the dog there. I don't think he was that political at all. I think Lachlan's far more political. I think James is – as you say, James is far more political. I think Elizabeth is probably far more political. I think Anna, his actually second wife, so Lachlan, Elizabeth and James's mum, was far more political in a different sense, probably in a left-wing sense. I think it's one of the great legacies, not in terms of great as in good, but great in terms of what he accomplished. I don't see anybody being able to do that again across so many different...
The size of the achievement, you mean?
Exactly.
I agree. The other thing that I think is remarkable is this. Rupert conquered the US a long time before Catapult conquered the US, and arguably he conquered it in a bigger way than we have. But
similar.
Yeah, you know, same order of magnitude. And so I want to tell you how hard it was for me and for us going to the US as an Australian, because just to give a snapshot of what I think it must have been like for him, but really in a much more significant way. So when we first went to the US with Catapult and we started meeting with some potential investors over there before we were publicly listed and venture capitalists and whatever else, Do you know what the number one refrain I got in response to like me pitching Catapult was from these Americans?
No.
It was, there must be, like, this all looks fantastic, but I just can't believe there's not an American company that is doing something better. That was that's the right. number
you have,
one.
You have told me this. You have
yeah, that. I heard that consistently. And in the end, the way we overcame it is that I went and persuaded a guy called Mark Cuban, who is a big shot billionaire, owns the Dallas Mavericks, you know, on Entourage, like a very well-known guy. And so he basically went, and the Dallas Mavericks were using our tech early.
Yeah.
He's a very forward-thinking guy. And he went around telling everyone, this is like the next big thing. Like these Aussies are legit. And that was one of the things that really helped us overcome this perception that, you know, Australians were somehow a bit of a step below what the US could do. And I'm certain that Rupert Murdoch would have faced a much more severe version of that.
Absolutely. In,
when he went to the US. And I think the...
And the UK. All,
and the... maybe even worse in the UK because of the condescension towards Australians.
They called him the dirty digger, from memory. They still do.
Right. I mean, and, you know, I've got no doubt that as rich as he is and as powerful as he is, and, you know, he is immensely powerful, and arguably he was more powerful before the internet age, but he's immensely powerful. I've got no doubt that through all of this, he has consistently seen himself as an outsider. And that somebody that is not allowed into the room and is like on the outside looking in, because like that was probably a hallmark of his international expansion as an Australian at the time that he did it.
He's easily the most successful. Like in terms, if you look at, and wealth isn't the best guide because there's so many different. And I did a quick back of the envelope because obviously some of the Murdoch wealth has now been shared amongst the kids.
Yeah.
But when I sort of calculate, I think Jack Lachlan's about 2.7. This is US billion, James 2, Elizabeth 2. Rupert at 17 point something. If you add them all up, it gets to about 24, 25 billion. And I think Gina Reinhart's about the same, according to Forbes. So he's pretty, and obviously Gina's, that could change if the iron ore price goes down. So Murdoch will, let's assume Murdoch passes, obviously his mum lives a long time, but Murdoch is pretty much on par with Gina Reinhart and slightly ahead of Andrew Forrest in terms of the wealthiest ever Australian. And you'd argue that Murdoch probably achieved more. They both Murdoch and Gina inherited something, and they both did exceptionally well with what they inherited. But I think what Murdoch did across three different continents, multiple different businesses, multiple different forms of sort of media, from newspapers to satellite to internet to TV, obviously, has been the greatest achievement of any Australian business person.
And, you know, he is the most powerful business person to have come out of Australia. As you said, he's probably the richest. He is the highest profile. He is the most connected. I completely agree with you. I think, you know, in both Gina Reinhart's, I think his business, you know, what he built is much more complicated than some of the other businesses that, you know, are at the top of the rich list in Australia. But I think in both Gina Reinhart's case and Rupert Murdoch's case, you'd have to say like what they started with, you know, was a hell of a lot better than starting with nothing. But what they built in no way resembles what they started with.
Yeah,
in both cases, it was like a completely remarkable situation. I think the fundamental difference is Rupert Murdoch's success has come from understanding what people want, knowing which deals to do in order to get it there. Like he's been really a transactional operator and having a level of risk tolerance that is second to none as far as I can see. Like nothing seems to scare him in terms of taking a risk.
On that note, let's move on to our regular spot, which I like to call Goiter Watch. So as you know, we've got a big $200 lunch bet on with whether Richard Goiter, chairman of Qantas, will last 6 months.
It's a 400.
So far.
I want to stop you. It's not a $200 bet. It's a $400 bet because when you lose, you cannot sit there and just watch me eat. You have to eat as well. And that's two lots of $200.
That's true. But presumably the person's getting value for their own food. So
you will not feel like you're getting $200 of value from your food.
Yeah, it won't be a very nice lunch for the loser. But so it's been another week and Goiter's hanging on. Things have actually gotten worse for him. So in the last week, it's been discovered that not only did Qantas know about this ACCC investigation, but they knew about the ACCC investigation when they paid, sorry, when they let Alan Joyce sell $20 million of shares at literally the top of the market. Share price is now down to $5.50, so the lowest it's been in a year. Goiter's still somehow hanging on. Claims he's got the support of shareholders, God knows how. And surely these super funds have to start flexing their muscle here.
You know what plot armor is? Do you know what that means? Plot armor? It means if a character is fundamental to whatever narrative is going on. So you have it in video games a lot. So there are some characters in video games that are fundamental to the long-term narrative of that game. And whatever happens, they can't die because they're too fundamental to the story. That's called plot armor. And so I think Richard Goyder, he might have plot armor. He's too central to the story of Qantas to actually go. Like, I think he is just going to hold on. He is part of this story. What are they going to write about in the papers when they're writing about Qantas if Goyder is not there to write about and they can't pin it on him? He survived another week. You're right, it's gotten worse. Like, the water that was up to his neck is probably now just below his nose. But I think he's going to hang on, I'm telling you.
I think that point is what you just said was right, in that he, to stop this narrative, to stop the Qantas constantly in the press, stop Joe constantly writing these unbelievably good articles about Qantas, Goyder has to go. He's like, once Goyder goes, there's actually no one to talk about because Goyder and obviously Joyce are gone. But whilst Goyder is Joyce's man, or Joyce is Goyder's man, whatever, however you want to say it, they're inextricably linked. He said he was the best CEO by length of the straight. Everything Joyce did, Goyder signed off on, you'd assume, or he was asleep at the wheel. Either way, it's bad. Goyder is as responsible for the disaster that he's Qantas at the moment as Alan Joyce.
I tell you why he's got plot armor and can't go. Because the hero of this story needs to be Vanessa Hudson, the new CEO. And if he goes, then the focus is going to switch to her and the fact that she's internal succession and she was part of everything that went on. And maybe they need a new CEO from the outside to clean out the culture. And so nobody wants like the Vanessa Hudson character to end up with all of the fire on them. And so I think my guess is that around the boardroom table, that is one of the considerations, that better the fire is directed at Richard Goyder than it turns on the CEO that they just appointed. Because I can tell you from personal experience, there is nothing worse as a chairman than losing a CEO without a succession plan to roll straight into a new CEO. It's a terrible situation, much worse in a public company. I've been through that, and it's not something you want to go through. So I think he might just be drawing the fire so that she doesn't take the fire.
There's probably an element of that, but if essentially, and we talked about Joyce last week, and essentially there comes to a point where the humiliation for Goyder becomes too much. This is a guy who a year ago was the doyen of corporate Australia. He was chairman of the AFL, chairman of Qantas, chairman of Woodside. He's still obviously chairman of the other two. He had a pretty good reputation as CEO of Wesfarmers. That Wesfarmers CEO reputation was undeserved, but he had it. He's now, obviously, AFL CEO transition's been completely botched. Gill, who I think is a good CEO, has probably been there a bit too long. Woodside's had its issues. And then you've got this disaster at Qantas, which has gone from the second most loved company to the 150th or something in Australia. So it's been just an absolute catastrophe.
People have short memories. I'm telling you, Qantas will be fixed in 6 months. It'll be nice to fly again. You know, Vanessa Hudson is already doing all of the right things with a high degree of urgency. She can do things because she doesn't have baggage. I think if he can survive, people will move on. And corporate Australia will find their next villain or the next problem or whatever it might be. This is how life, this is the beauty of life. The beauty of life is if you're under fire and you can just survive it, then the fire shifts somewhere else. And people forget about the fact that you're under fire and you can just move on. Like, that is one of the nice things about, you know, when you feel like you're in the trough of life, actually you just have to hang on because it'll turn.
Ultimately, this whole Qantas thing would have passed. Because remember the whole Qatar thing, which started this disaster. Obviously, the ACCC thing came up the top. But the whole Qatar thing, the only reason that stayed in that was even a story was because Joe pushed it. Nobody else thought about it. Nobody else pushed it. Joe isn't going to let, I haven't spoken to Joe about this, but I'm pretty sure Joe's not going to let Rich Goyder get away with this till he goes. Joe wants his scalp. He deserves his scalp. Hopefully, for the sake of my lunch, Bill, he'll get his scalp. But this is, it is untenable, him remaining as chairman of this business. Untenable.
We'll see. We'll see.
On that note, say goodbye. Have you got a big week planned?
Oh, it feels like every week's a big week, doesn't it? It's school holidays. That compounds the workload.
It does. I'm off to Sydney next week, but I've got my brother-in-law staying in the house. I've got a pretty busy house at the moment.
Enjoy that.
I will.
No wonder you're so keen to do these podcasts.
And we'll wrap up the episode there. Look forward to seeing you all next week. As always, a big thanks to our incredible sponsors, Bench Media, Remont Advisory, and Bowden Financial, for making the show happen.
Thank you for listening to The Contrarians with Adam and Adir. If you want to submit a question for the show, please send a voice recording to Adam J. Schwab at Instagram. Today's show was produced by Kieran Brown. Make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. And don't forget to give us a rating and tell your friends. We'll be back next week for our weekly analysis of all things growth and tech.